I was raised Baptist. I'm from Alabama.
What part of Alabama?
Birmingham.
Mobile.
So, really?
Yeah,
so,
my dad's, you're my down dad's Mobile. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I call Mobile like a New Orleans internship. Exactly.
From Topic and Earwolf, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kanal Bell.
And I'm the Mac Daddy and the Daddy Mac. Hari Kondabolu.
Jump.
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
Yes, we want to make politics understandable again, like it used to be. Remember when it was understandable, when we all knew exactly what was going on, and nothing was a mystery to anybody?
Nope, I don't remember that.
On today's show, we're joined by comedian and Daily Show correspondent Roy Wood Jr.
Everyone loves weed. It's the Bruno Mars of drugs. You not anticipate the demand? It's like if you opened up an orgasm store, but you only kept 3 orgasms in stock. Then you're like, damn, people really like orgasms. Can you believe that? And by the way, Nevada, you don't need to call a state of emergency just because you ran out of weed. Just call up any white dude with dreadlocks.
And Roy has a new stand-up special on Comedy Central right now called Father Figure. Hey, hurry, isn't it great to be a dad?
Yes, it is great to be a father. I have a child, and it is great to be a father. I don't have a child. Francesca Ramsey shows up and talks to me about slang trolls.
She went viral in 2012 with her video, Shit White Girls Say to Black Girls.
Not to sound racist.
Francesca also hosts the MTV web series Decoded, which takes on a range of issues, including knocking out trans tropes and debunking poverty myths.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Kamau.
Hey, man. I'm in a car headed to the airport.
Yeah, I hear something. I'm in my childhood bedroom. So if there's times when I whisper, it's because my parents are sleeping and I'm going to have to keep it down. So these are the ideal conditions.
So this past Sunday, it was sort of funny. You texted me at one point, hey, man, could you retweet my tweet about my show tonight in Baltimore? Yeah. And I was like, I'm a little busy right now. I'm in the middle of a protest in Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, if I had known, I wouldn't have asked.
You know, I think I was in the middle of walking down the street following Pastor Mike, who has been on the show. There was a protest in Berkeley this past weekend. The alt-right and white supremacists said they were going to show up. And me and Melissa thought, we got to be there. And we actually talked to a bunch of people who were like, Kamau, you're so public. It might not be good for you to be there. You'll be targeted. Yeah. So, you know, and we were, and me and Melissa struggled with, should we go? Should I go? Should somehow I go? And Melissa's not with me, so she's not caught up in something. And I just, the thing I kept remembering was every picture of the civil rights movement of MLK walking down the middle of the street, joined arm in arm with other people, some of whom were famous, some of whom were not. But I was like, I can't imagine in history, like one day saying to my kids, where were you when they had that, the No Hate in the Bay rally? Me and your mom got this great bed and breakfast in Sausalito, and we just had some time for us. So we went, they had a church service that morning. We went to the church service. I haven't been to church. First of all, I've never gone to church in my adult life of my own volition. Like, I visited my dad and sort of like, are we doing that church thing again this Sunday? You know, like, you wake up on a Sunday, like, just going to hang out and watch TV. Oh, we're doing church? Like, that's happened to me in my adult life. But this is the first time in my adult life I was like, in the midst of all this stuff, it was like, yeah, I think I need to be at church. It just felt so connected to the history of like, the black people in this country. Like, yeah, I think this starts at church, and then we go on a march. That's what we're supposed to do right now.
Right. I think it's interesting when, you know, because part of the left, certainly there's like this anti-religious sentiment or, the idea of atheism without really understanding that like religion has a great deal of importance and organizing. Oh, I forgot to say, fuck Bill Maher. But like, these are the moments where you see why it's important to like draw strength from each other and the idea of a higher power if you believe in one. And even if you do not believe one or on the fence, there's still something spiritual about sharing such an experience with other people.
Like for me, it's something like I walked into the room and it was packed, and it was like also the most black people I'd been around in one particular part of Berkeley ever. Like, Berkeley's not really thought of as a black city, so it was a room of mostly black people. And I almost, like, I got, like, overwhelmed. I was, like, I almost started to cry, and I was, like, pull it together. And then at some points, I'm laughing. Oops. Now, and at this point, I'm jumping out of the car. I'm good, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
What's wild also is the fact that this is the lighter story this week.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, the only thing I want to say about Berkeley in the rally is that there's been a lot of talk about, like, the Antifa causing violence and fighting people. And I was there, and Nato Green, our friend Nato Green, was there. Yeah. And he said he was in the middle of the rally. And there's all this talk about how there was, you know, tear gas and fights. He's like, Nato said he was in the middle of the rally. His phone alert went off and told him there's tear gassing in Berkeley. And he found out from his phone while he was in the rally.
Oh, my God.
So it's like, he was like, there is? I'm not experiencing that. So the media overall, left, right, in the middle, has done a really poor job of actually telling the story. It was somewhere between 3,000 or 4,000 people peacefully protesting and marching. And then some people who did it a different way. A few small percentage of people did it a different way. So the whole thing was an amazing experience. But yes, that is not the story that's being covered this week. Luckily, nobody was hurt. A few people were arrested. There were some injuries. Nobody died. But yeah, the media didn't really spend a lot of time on the Berkeley story because of the Hurricane Harvey in Houston.
Yeah, which is, I don't even know. How does a man make a hurricane about himself? I could not, like, Donald Trump made this hurricane in Houston, a hurricane that's killed 30 people up to this recording, about himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Because earlier in the week, he had pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's a real piece of shit, and he was convicted. I don't know the exact charge, but I believe he was convicted of being a piece of shit. And he got pardoned by President Trump, and he did it around the time of the hurricane because he said the ratings would be higher.
Well, you know, it was there was this real thing they call the Friday news dump in the media when, like, the government will dump out a bunch of news stories that they don't want to be covered. And it was like the banning of transgender people from joining the military, pardoning Arpaio. There was something else. I think he said something. I think he signed that nobody's allowed to have cake ordinance or law again.
Right.
But it was just, and I was about to do a show in Pittsburgh, and, like, as I'm about to go on stage, these things happen. And I was like, had to go on stage, like, I got some breaking news, everybody. Like, this is what horrible thing is happening while also this hurricane is headed towards Texas. In the middle of him tweeting, Trump tweeting about the hurricane and saying things that sound right, he's also still tweeting about his enemies and tweeting about Arpaio. So it's like this mix of, like, we can do this, we'll all come together, and also this person is an asshole.
Right.
And Obama sent out a tweet like, "Are my prayers and thoughts with Houston. We have to help our first responders, donate to the Red Cross." And so I tweeted to Trump, "President, oops, can you hear that?"
Yeah, you're at the airport.
I'm at the airport. Hold on, I'm waiting for this to stop.
God, I got to be in an airport in like less than 12 hours. Jeez.
This is how we do it.
I don't think that was the spirit of that song come out.
Also, I really hope that the recording has picked up the hits of the 80s that are being played behind me during my last rant. So I tweeted to President Trump because Obama sent out this tweet that felt very like, oh yeah, that's how a president is supposed to tweet. And so I tweeted to Trump, presidential hack, hashtag presidential hack. Just retweet this guy.
You know, I think it's been hard to figure out who to donate to, you know, because you constantly hear, don't donate here, don't donate here. If you could, you could support the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund established by Mayor Sylvester Turner, Global Giving, the Coalition for the Homeless of Houston and Harris County, Feeding Texas, Portlight Strategies, which provides post-disaster relief work for people with disabilities, and the SPCA of Texas. There's also, if you want to do more research, there's a site called Charity Navigator, so you know who to support and where that money is going. So, you know, it's hard to always know, like, should I be giving it to here or here? And what's the best use of the resources? But at least, you know, you could do a little bit of research and try to figure out where it goes. I mean, it's weird just also hearing about the story, I mean, of they're undocumented people who are afraid to ask for help because they're afraid they're going to be deported. This is where we're at, but people are dying and they're afraid to leave.
Good job, America.
The one thing I'm just, I am amazed by is this mayor of Houston, like, you know, I don't know much about him, but how he's handled this seems quite wonderful. But one thing that he did say, this is Sylvester Turner, is that if there is an issue with any of these folks' immigration status or if there is a risk of deportation, he said he would personally represent them because he, you know, he's a lawyer, Harvard graduate. Like, he said he would personally represent them. Like
the mayor of Houston did?
Yes, Sylvester Turner.
Jesus. Oh, yeah. This is one of those things that's like, what's he doing in 2020? Got any interest in running for the highest office in the land?
I mean,
also, I want to say, as you list a bunch of places that people should donate money to, I would just like to encourage you not to donate money to Joel Osteen.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Joel Osteen, whose church following got so big, he bought the basketball arena that the Houston Rockets used to play in. It holds over 16,000 people. And he tweeted out, me and my wife's thoughts or prayers with the people of Houston. And people said, how about your square footage inside your basketball arena? Are they with the people of Houston? And then he sent out a link to say donate money. And when you clicked on a link, it was to his site.
Motherfucker. I didn't know that.
It's like, he's like, well, I got to, you know, putting this webpage up costs money. So I got to take something off the top, you know.
Oh, my God.
The last minute thing, somebody to build you a webpage. So I had to take something off the top. Yeah. And then he finally now has opened up his doors apparently. And he's tweeted out pictures of, but it took way longer than it should have for a man of God.
Yeah. But to be fair, Kamau, I mean, it does take a couple of days to move all that gold out of the arena. it's hard to keep up. There's just so much. All this stuff is so heavy. Like the Arpaio thing would have been like alone would have been the story of another situation. We would have focused on the Joe Arpaio thing, Arpaio. And
please pronounce his name correctly, Harry. Please.
Sorry, Arpaiola. How about that?
Yeah. Look at Ding. that was in honor of Jerry Lewis's passing.
But we do have a show today. We have a couple of great guests. We have Francesca Ramsey.
And the other interview is Roy Wood Jr., who is on The Daily Show and also has his first comedy special out on Comedy Central, Father Figure. So, yeah, this week is filled with black people who are doing big things.
Yeah, and I think it'll be, you know, there's some poignancy, there's a lot of humor, and I think it's a rough week, it's a hard week. I think this will be a nice relief for some of you, and I hope you enjoyed as much as we did.
Also, let me be clear, Hari. I'm sorry I didn't retweet your thing about your show. I did feel bad about that.
It's fine.
After it was said and done, I went home. I was like, oh my God, I stood up for justice and inclusion and a more accepting society, but I forgot to retweet my friend's link to his tickets.
Appreciate that, man. I felt like such a piece of shit, by the way. After I texted, I felt like such a piece of shit. You were, Martin Luther Kinging it. I was Joel Osteening it. Oh, if the people got to pay money.
Wow. That's so Joel Osteen. That's a great that's a great expression for when you're not living up to your principles. Joel Osteen it. Joining me now is one of my favorite people, Francesca Ramsey. I've known Francesca for a long time. We actually brought her in the early days of Totally Biased. Somehow she didn't get a job. It's one of my great shames. She's going to talk to Hari about online harassment, also how to drop bite-sized knowledge. Her show Decoded, which is an MTV web series, tackles race, class, identity, and every other issue that we need to talk about. In just a matter of about 5 minutes, it's super funny. It's the kind of show where you watch and you go, oh, I finally know what to send to my racist uncle. It's that kind of show. In 2017, it won a Webby Award for Public Service and Activism. See, comedy can help. Francesca is currently working on a pilot for her own late-night comedy show on Comedy Central. Let's get to it. I wasn't there. They should get to it.
This interview was recorded on August 14th, 2017. On this day in 1825, Dutch King Willem I throws foreign students out. You probably did not know or care about that.
Hey, Francesca.
Hi.
I mean, I've loved your work for so long, and you've made videos for years, but in particular, I love that Decoded series.
Thank
that you're
you
doing.
So much.
Yeah, I feel like if you want to be able to relate to people, you have to say things that are relatable, and the fact that, yeah, I didn't get this either. Yeah, I also make mistakes.
Right.
You know, it has to not feel luxury as much as it's like a friend explaining information. And
totally.
I think you do that so well.
Thank
and
you.
With such humor. And
I appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, and here's the thing. Like, I will be transparent and call myself out to say that that's something that I have not always been good at. And I think especially when it comes to like serious issues, when you learn something, you get like enraged, rightfully so, yeah. and you're like pissed off. It can be really easy when someone says the wrong thing to be like, how dare you? And you're like, wait a second, I learned this thing a week ago.
Right,
am I freaking out? I just learned what that word meant. Or I just learned that you're not supposed, or it's not socially acceptable to say this thing anymore, or whatever it is, you know?
This is the history of that phrase, this is what
right,
that means.
Right. And I think, again, it can be really easy to come from a place of, I know and you don't know, and why don't you? And it's
right.
like, well, I don't know because my school didn't freaking teach me.
Right.
Or like, I never met somebody from this background before, or whatever it
right.
is.
Right. And the TV uses these phrases, so I use the things that everyone else is saying. And,
right.
Yeah.
Or I watch some like shitty, awful YouTuber who says X, Y, and Z, and so now I think it's acceptable to say
this thing.
You know?
Basically, it's in the water, so how can we be completely blamed for it being in the water?
Right, yeah. I think you had that joke about, or I've seen this quote attributed to you about, like, telling me I'm obsessed with racism is like telling a fish they're obsessed with water. It's kind of this idea that, like, we are surrounded by things, and sometimes we don't even realize that we're surrounded by them and how much they're influencing us.
Yes.
And that goes through for good and for bad. And I feel like for those of us who are quote unquote woke, we have to remember that like at some point we had to be awoken.
Yes.
And we didn't always see the forest from the through the trees or whatever. I don't know. I'm putting a lot of analogies on like fish and water and
the phrase,
trees.
The phrase is telling me that I'm obsessed with talking about racism in America is like telling me I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning.
Oh, okay.
And it's weird because it was supposed to be...
I turned you into a fish.
Yeah. Well, it's strange when people started, like, that turned into a bit of a meme and it showed up on posters
mm-hmm.
at rallies and
yes.
things. And I remember just being shocked because it was a setup to a joke.
Mm.
It wasn't the joke.
Right.
It was just like an analogy I used to get into the thing. And
yeah, but it
funny.
Resonated with a lot of people because I've seen posters of people holding them at like rallies
yeah.
and protests, and they go like super viral. And it's always really cool to see.
I mean, so much of your work has been focused on the internet. I mean, have you ever, because I've thought about this, just like, what if I stepped away?
Ugh. I have such like a love-hate relationship with the internet because, you know, I grew up online.
Mm-hmm.
I built my first website in middle school.
Oh, my God. You did?
I did. I went to computer camp in like eighth grade and learned HTML.
Oh, my God.
And got just really into the internet. I begged my parents for a computer. And it was just something that was always a big part of my life. And I've met so many great friends like you and Kamal. Like, I've created all these awesome opportunities for myself, but it just made me really accessible to a lot of people who either don't respect my time or respect me and can be really hateful and really just go out of their way to try and like knock me off my path, or are just like, gimme, 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 gimme.
Right, right,
you
right,
know?
Right.
And it's like, because I don't necessarily have like work hours,
yeah.
it just doesn't stop.
Like, every day's vacation, every day's work.
Every single minute of the day because of the internet is
yeah.
time that I am essentially working.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been difficult. I realized that I'm like low-key addicted. Like,
yeah.
honestly, like, just, like, the scroll is just, like, so mindless.
Have you woken up in the middle of the night and your first move is to check your phone? 3 a.m.
It's so bad that I had to delete, like, Facebook and Snapchat and
Whoa.
Everything off my phone. Like, I kept them because, like, I can't delete them for, you know, career purposes and just to connect with people. But just not having them on my phone has been so freeing.
So you, like, re-download it when you have to and then use it and then delete it again.
I have it on my desktop.
Okay.
And but I took it off of my phone.
So right now you could not tweet.
No.
Wow.
No, I mean, I can tweet from my desktop, but on my phone, no. And it's been, it's like I said, it's been hard because I started finding myself checking my phone or, you know, I was cooking dinner and I'm just like, what do I do right now? I don't have Twitter to just mindlessly scroll through. I guess I have to just be in my own brain.
Did you get a pen and paper to write them down for, like, I got this thought, let me just write it down. That's, at least that allows for the potential, because whenever I write things on paper, I immediately think of, well, then what's the next sentence or the sentence after that? As opposed to Twitter, it's like, well, that's done.
Right.
Like, it actually leads me to write more when I actually write it on paper.
I think it was just, for me, nice to have my thoughts be uninterrupted because I feel like so much of Twitter is like, oh, actually, did you mean this? Oh, what you were really saying was this? Why aren't you talking about this? And you're just like, can I just think about what I want to think about for 2 seconds? Whereas when you do not have like that stream of what everybody else is saying, you could just kind of float away and think about whatever you want. And I realized I have not done that in a really long time.
I mean, the great thing is that we know what that's like, right? Because we actually grew up at a certain point before the internet.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Oh, that's what worries me about kids. Like, do they know what to do when they're unplugged?
Wait, can we just talk about that moment in your life where you start very earnestly saying, I'm worried about the children? Do you know what I mean?
No.
Where, like, where you used to be cool and young and hip. I mean, and I say this as someone that says it all the time, where I'm like, think of the children. Yeah. But I really mean it. And it troubles me because I think, like, wow, this means I've crossed over.
Yeah, into that place.
I am an adult and I'm looking at today's youth and realizing that I am completely disconnected from them.
I mean, do you ever think what your life would be without the internet?
I think I would still be interested in entertainment. Yeah. I think that it just would have possibly just taken me longer to find my own voice. Because for me, the internet was really a place where I could create content because I wasn't getting opportunities in entertainment. And I wasn't finding – I was getting called on auditions, but they just were for things that I wasn't interested in or for parts that I felt were really one-dimensional or stereotypical. And so, again, like, no shade to people that take those roles, right? Because I feel like – I think it's more important to criticize the system that says that those are the only way that we see women or, you know – marginalized people or people of color or LGBT folk or whatever it is, rather than the people that take those roles. So I feel like if the internet hadn't been there for me, it would have taken me a lot longer because I would like to think that my morals would be such that I would still turn work down, but I don't know. Maybe I would have taken some of those or those auditions that I didn't take because I was like, well, I don't need to take that audition. I don't need to take that job because I have a source of income or I have other things going on for myself.
It's funny because I feel like when people of color get work and you see a wider range, it's still not where it should be, but a wider range of depictions and characters and stories being made, that's not because there's goodwill in Hollywood. That has to do with, oh, they make us money too, and we didn't know. There was money to be made, and the internet proves
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I have called it. I mean, I don't know if I'm giving her too much credit, but I called it the Shonda Rhimes effect only because when Scandal first came out and was a big hit, that pilot season, I got called for more auditions than I'd ever been called for in my life and didn't book one.
Yeah.
But, I mean, every single script that I was reading had a black female character in it, and it was so cool to see. And it sucks that that's what it takes.
Right.
But in some ways, all of entertainment is like that. Like, one vampire movie does well, and then there's like 30 vampire movies and like TV shows and comic books and cartoons that are all around that same theme. So I guess maybe that makes me not take it personally, but at the same time, I'm like, it's a net positive. I'm glad that more of us are getting work.
Well, it's a fascinating benefit of oppression. For years of not getting our voices heard, now everything we say is innovative and new because they have never asked us. I mean, I'm releasing this documentary about Apu at the end
of
the year.
I'm so excited.
I am also excited
about this documentary.
And the weird thing about it is, You know, I initially did a piece on Totally Biased, the show that Kamau used to have, that I was a writer for and a correspondent.
There's now enough Indian people where I don't need to like you just because you're Indian. Because growing up, I had no choice but to like this. Yeah. Apu, a cartoon character voiced by Hank Azaria, a white guy. A white guy doing an impression of a white guy making fun of my father.
And I didn't want to do it because it just felt so corny. And
really?
Because Kamau had to explain to me, you think it's corny because you and your friends and community have talked about this for years.
But to us, it was. Yeah. I shared the trailer for the documentary on my Facebook.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting for me to read the comments because I knew that Apu was not voiced by an Indian man.
Yeah.
What's his name? I can't.
Hank Azaria.
Hank Azaria. Yeah. I didn't know him by name. I'm terrible with names. But I knew. But seeing how many people in my comments, people who are socially conscious, very well read, yeah, and have been exposed to all these conversations, were dumbfounded. Number of them were just could not believe how offensive and racist that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really that moment of you don't know what other people don't know.
Yes.
And right, like you've been having this conversation, which is why it's so cool that you featured so many actors and comedians who can talk about their personal experience,
right,
with the character growing up. But for a lot of us, we were like, wait, I never thought about it that way.
Right, right. And it's kind of interesting to... It almost feels like, wow, these are our little secrets and we're sharing them finally. I don't know how to feel about like these, like this used to be our inside thing and now people know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think it's really cool in the sense that you can't fix a problem if you don't know the problem exists.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and so that's why I always get so frustrated when people say like, just stop talking about race and it'll go away. Mm. You know, I always use the analogy of like, if you get cancer, the doctor's not going to be like, just don't think about it and it'll go away. Like,
yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah.
A new cancer comes out and we raise money and we study it and we do tests and we do experiments and then, you know, you find a cure. And so that's how I feel like we have to look at all of society's problems. So if we want better representation for people of color, then we need to talk about what's wrong with the representation that currently exists in order to encourage people to start creating better characters or just casting people that don't all look the same,
yeah,
for characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How do you pick what you're going to talk about in Decoded?
We go through a mix of things. I mean, I listen to the audience in terms of what they're asking for.
Like comments and emails.
Comments and messages. Yeah. And sometimes we do things that are topical, but especially with my schedule right now, we really kind of focus on more evergreen topics because we don't know. And so we really try to like look at the landscape and then see what things we can use to inspire us. We really love looking at like the etymology of words. So, for example, we did an episode, are the words white trash and redneck racist? And looked at the history of those words. We do a lot of things around...
What did you come up with?
It was really interesting. We talked about classism versus racism.
That's interesting.
And like who actually created those words and what the purpose of the words white trash and redneck and cracker were for.
Let's start with cracker. While linguistic history is always murky, recent research has shown that in the 16 and 1700s, British aristocrats used cracker as a shortened version of cracked brains, or idle-headed, to disparage lower-class people as dumb and lazy. It was then imported to colonial America and used by wealthy elites to disparage poor whites.
Words, in order for them to be tools of oppression, they need to actually uphold someone's oppression. And so while classism is a terrible thing, classism and racism are not the same thing. Or even talking about why privilege makes people angry or, you know, this is actually very on point for what's going on right now. Why does white pride make people uncomfortable? So like these are questions that a lot of people have. And maybe they feel embarrassed about. And so we think of Decoded as a place to answer some of those questions that maybe you just genuinely don't understand. Like someone has to do that 101. So it's really kind of us looking at what are things that people are unclear on and how can we explain it in a fun way.
How do you deal with trolls? Because I just mute them at this point. I mute them unless I can come up with a really good comeback, and then I'll, you know.
Yeah, I've been on like a roller coaster with trolls lately.
We're talking about internet trolls.
Yes. I most recently am trying to just like not respond to them at all. I used to engage with them a lot, and I have engaged with them a lot over the course of my career. And I think everybody has to decide what their strategy is. You know, sometimes if you have like a really funny SmackDown comment, then it's a win-win for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also the thing that like really started changing my approach was on like Stormfront, which is one of those like white supremacist message boards. They had like a step-by-step instruction of how to troll me. And
what do you mean?
they had like a whole they had like a Stormfront Wikipedia on me and my husband.
Stormfront has a Wikipedia?
I just called it that in the sense that they were like, meet Francesca Ramsey, the latest like insert racial slur, like black girl, and she hosts Decoded, and here's why she's awful, and here are some of her terrible videos she's made, and she's really easy to like troll because she responds a lot. And so they like had screenshots of people just provoking me into getting a response from me, you know? And sometimes I would, you know, of course say something that I thought was funny or clever, but in that moment I realized, oh wow, like these people are genuinely getting off on the fact that I am engaging with them.
And this is on the racist page, Stormfront, like the white supremacist.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like a message. They have like a message board there where they just write about different activists and political figures that they want to try and harass. And then I also started just thinking about the fact that every time I engaged with those people, it was taking me away from my fans and people that actually liked my work, and how unfair it was to them that they, you know, were messaging me and saying like, oh, it's my birthday, please say happy birthday to me, it would make my like day so much better. And instead I'm engaging with like a Confederate flag who's just saying like awful, hateful things about me that are not true, and I'm going back and forth with them and it's accomplishing absolutely nothing. Right?
I've been trying to figure out like, how does harassing you lead to white superiority? Like, how does that lead to a white supremacist state?
Here's the thing, and maybe this is like super conspiracy theory, but I don't necessarily think it leads to white supremacy in the like one-to-one sense. But I think that these people's goal is to distract you and keep you from achieving what it is you're supposed to achieve. You know, when they go after someone like a Leslie Jones, who they're seeing as, you know, a black woman who has dark skin and does not fit their like European or white standards of beauty. And they think, well, what we're going to do is we're going to drive her off the internet, and hopefully we can force her into quitting. Maybe we will just attack her so fervently that she'll just give up, right? And that's what they want. And especially with someone like Leslie, for example, she never gave that to them. It just made them angrier,
right?
Like they're very, and it's not just, you know, black women, even though we do take a lot of shit online. I see this with my LGBT creators too, where people are so unhappy that they are posting pictures of them with their partners, or my friends, my like fat body positive activist, right? How dare you like your body, right? And it's this, not just they feel you're inferior or they're superior to you, but I genuinely believe that their goal is to try and keep you from being focused on your own community, on uplifting yourself, on the work that you're doing. And every time you give them attention, you are giving them what they want. Yeah. Suddenly I'm like, oh shit, I should have been working on my book instead of like sitting on Twitter for how long, right?
I mean, it also creates a certain camaraderie. Like, remember when we tried to destroy Francesca Ramsey together?
Oh, listen.
Now let's start marching.
I swear to you, I posted a screenshot of this on my personal Facebook page just to not give this person the satisfaction. But this girl tweeted, she tagged me in a tweet, and it was like, never forget a year ago today, Francesca Ramsey blocked me on Twitter.
Oh my God.
And I couldn't help but wonder, did she put this on her calendar? Why? And people put it in their bios.
The sadness of that.
Blocked by Francesca Ramsey. People make these really long videos about it. I'm talking like 15, 20 minute videos about
getting blocked.
It's very strange. It's flattering in the sense that these people are really investing a lot of time in it.
Yeah.
But you have to remind yourself that anyone that spends that much time thinking about people that they don't like, it's because they're not happy. I mean, how could you be, right? Yeah. Like, it's just a very strange thing.
I've thought about this a lot just in terms of getting criticized from the left, like, I didn't do enough of this, mm-hmm. or you missed a step here. And yeah, you're upset that something you know, that something we said was not quite what you agree with, or you're disappointed. But how about the fact we're the ones on the Stormfront website?
Right. I mean, I feel like at some point, and this is, I'm trying to do this work for myself and in that way, hope that I can encourage other people to do it. But to remember the times that I fucked up and somebody took the time to walk me through it and give me the space to learn from it, to say that I should try and do that for other people. I mean, at the end of the day, there are some people who don't deserve it, right? There are some people who are just really proud to be racist, proud to be sexist, proud to be ignorant on whatever issue it is. And then there are some people who are genuinely trying to do the work, and it doesn't make the fuck up any less hurtful or disappointing, but somebody has to find the time or the space in their heart to take them aside and be like, listen up, can we talk about this thing that you said?
Yeah. And chances are it's not going to be the internet alone.
The internet is the worst. Honestly, the internet is a great place to start conversations and expose people to stuff that they've never been exposed to if they want to be.
Yes.
But in my experience, again, as someone who's done this work a long time and someone who has screwed up a lot, nobody ever gets called out on being a racist or a sexist or a homophobe or whatever it is, and then gets piled on and then realizes like, oh, wow, you are all right. You
know, it
just doesn't happen. Maybe they come back and they just say like, okay, I'm never going to use that slur again, or I'm just going to delete my account or whatever it is.
It's just it's a cyber beatdown. Cyber? Is anybody saying cyber? Oh, my God.
No, we call it a dragging.
A dragging.
Yes.
Oh, my God, Francesca. How do I not know this?
You don't know about getting dragged? Clearly, you've not been dragged.
No, I guess I have been dragged, but the word cyber.
Yeah, no, people don't say that
says
anymore.
Nobody says information superhighway. That's gone.
No.
Surfing the web?
No, people don't say that anymore.
Francesca, thank you so much for doing this. I know that's a weird way to stop.
No, it's okay. This has been really cathartic because I think, especially because of the internet, we forget that there are people that deal with this stuff
or
think about these things. And it's just really inspiring to see people who, despite those obstacles, are still like kicking ass and making great work. And so, it's always great to be supported and support you and Kamau.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
We'll be right back after we take care of some business. And some business.
All right, back to the show.
Let's go to Roy Wood Jr. Roy Wood Jr. joined Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Trevor Noah in 2015. He's also just been announced as the new host of the Comedy Central show, This Is Not Happening. And he has a stand-up special, also on Comedy Central, called Father Figure. Let's talk to Roy.
This interview was recorded on August 22nd, 2017. On this day in 1639, Madras, now Chennai, India, founded by the British East India Company on sliver of land bought from local Nayak rulers. On this day in 1642, there was a civil war in England between royalists and parliament. Serves them right.
Your dad, I got to welcome you into the dad club. How long have you been a dad now?
16 months now.
16 months. Oh, that's still brand new. It's still brand
new. Feels old.
I know, and it's going to feel older forever.
Oh my God.
I got two daughters. Yeah, I got a six-year-old and an almost three-year-old. Yeah.
Did you like, when you knew you were having a daughter, did you like immediately go into ninja training?
Well, it's funny. I was like, I didn't know. I guess I sort of thought I wanted a boy just because that's what I was told I wanted. And then when I was like heard I was having a daughter, I'm like, all right, we'll see how that works out. From the moment she showed up, I was like, oh, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be. Like, I'm so happy we had two daughters. I feel like, but like you're saying, ninja training, but also like I can give you all the inside shit.
Like, oh, I can, like, I'm going to be a double agent. Like, I'm going to tell you all the shit. Like, I'm going to give you all the secrets. Yeah.
You're like Steve Bannon. You left the male party.
Yep.
He's going to betray me.
My hands are my weapons again. Yeah, that's right.
My hands are my weapons.
Now, I know with my son, and I see it in his eyes already, we're going to have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're going to have that father-son man of the house showdown.
Yep.
And it's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's probably somewhere between age 13 to 16.
Yeah.
Where he's going to get really pissed with me about something. And that's why I feel like grabbing him now, like not physically grabbing his person, but like the shirt and just a little bit. Like when I move my son, like move from this part of the couch to the other part, I do it very fast and with a lot of strength. I'm just moving a child.
Yeah, but
with velocity.
Yeah. Just to let him know. Like, so he's like, whoa.
Yeah, to let him know what I could do, what I'm capable of.
He's so strong.
But he's 16 months. So what was the indication that that's what was going to happen when he turned about 13?
Because, so I have a sound bar on, it sits right below my television, and it's right at arm's length for him. Like, it's like the top of the shelf for him.
Mm.
And I've come home two or three times to my sound bar being on the ground, broken into like two or three pieces because he pulled it off the shelf. Which is fine. I'm not here to yell at you, hey, don't do that. No, sir, mister, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But when I'm home and he goes to the sound bar and I go, no, and he looks at it and then tries to touch it again. And then I say, no, again, then he stops. The fact that you're 16 months and I have to tell you something twice means when you're 13, I'm going to have to tell you 14 times. And I'm only going to tell you four.
Then
I got to yoke you up. For all of this, you'll enjoy it and parenting. And to me, it's just a constant state of paranoia and how do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
My girl loves it. She's having a blast being a mother. But I'm just like, religion and discipline. How do I navigate these?
Wow. Are you a religious person?
I was raised religious. I was raised Baptist. I'm from Alabama.
What part of Alabama?
Birmingham.
Mobile.
So, really?
Yeah,
so,
my dad's Mobile. Yeah.
Yeah, I call Mobile like a New Orleans internship.
Your kids in your promos for the Comedy Central special you did.
People
came
like out. Babies. Put that baby in there.
You need people
to watch this.
Babies don't need to be SAG-AFTRA, right?
No, not if it's yours.
Not if it's yours.
That was like one of the questions. Like, apparently one of the line producers or somebody at the shoot didn't know that that was my kid.
Right.
Is the mother here? Do the paperwork? I'm like, nah, he's mine. Oh, great, cool. So he can work however long he wants.
Then tell him to shut up.
Yeah, I thought to title the special father figure to me was about contemplating how to raise a kid in this world and in this climate, and to just let the special talk about some of those topics and things, because, you know, I do have to raise a child and explain racism to him.
Mm-hmm.
How do I explain racism without making him prejudice against white people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, look, this is what they used to do. There's some people who still believe this. You got to know how to trust them. You got to know how to read the body language, like that type. I had to teach him how to become a white whisperer, basically.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, the way in that I've learned is kids' books and dividing this discussion between, there's a difference between discussion about race and discussion about racism. You know what I mean? So, like, there's all.
No, what do you mean? What do you mean?
There's all these books. You can buy, like, all these books, like I have a book called Rad American Women. Actually, we had them on the show.
Right.
And it's, like, about, like, awesome women, you know, throughout history. And so a lot of that book is about race. Like, Flo Jo was one of the fastest runners ever, and she was so dope, and da-da-da, she did her own. And that's a book about how, look, you're a black woman, she's a black woman, black women are dope, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Okay, that's good.
That's the stuff that's like, isn't it great to be
self-esteem
black?
Self-esteem foundation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Isn't it great? Being black is awesome. You're being awesome. A black woman's awesome.
So that when someone goes, hey, darky, she can remember the Flo Jo passage. Just
like, nope, I'm like Flo Jo. You can't mess with me. So that's the piece about race. And then at some point, you bring in the part about racism, about like, now this is what it means. This is another part of what it means to be black. And so for me, like, I sort of relied on kids' books. Like, I literally went to Amazon and was like, kids' books on racism. And they're like, it's like an auto, like a kid, kid autobiography, not autobiography, a kid biography on Harriet Tubman came up. And it's just like a like any kid's book, but it happens to be about Harriet Tubman, and it's written like any kid's book. It's like, Harriet Tubman was born a slave. And you're just sort of saying this stuff, and then I'm like, as I'm reading the book, I'm like, let me explain. You know what I mean? So, like, it's a way to sort of, like, have the foundation of what this stuff is, but then get deliver them in a way that, that somebody else has already thought about how one can understand.
That would have been so much better for us growing up.
Yeah.
Before we moved to Birmingham, I lived in Memphis. My mother and I were in Memphis till the second grade, and then my parents reconciled and went to Birmingham. And the extent of the racism education in the South is just field trips to museums and historical mm-hmm. sites. Mm-hmm. It's really glazed over in the books. Mm-hmm. They don't really touch on it that much in the books, but Birmingham is a predominantly black school district, mostly black faculty, blah, 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 blah. But the books are approved by the state.
Yeah.
So they really have no control over the curriculum. So there was never racism and slavery and all of that shit was never broken down on a simplistic level. It was just, hey, we're going to Alex Haley's house today. And we did that.
That's funny.
We were in Memphis and we went on a field trip to see Alex Haley's birthplace or some house or whatever.
That's just funny. I mean, Alex Haley, yes, Roots, yes, the outbreak from Malcolm X. I don't know if I need to see his house.
As a first grader, you definitely don't need to see his house. As an adult,
yeah. Is it across the street?
What does his house look like?
It was just a regular ass house. Yeah,
he wasn't born in
that shit at all.
He wasn't born in the 1600s. He was born in the probably the early 1900s.
Yeah, so, yeah, this is his house, and this is where he wrote Roots. And Roots would come on every year.
There was his bicycle over there. And
yeah. So Alabama Public Television would show Roots every year, and you'd write a book report about that. You'd be assigned a Frederick Douglass or a Malcolm, like hardcore.
Yeah.
Like, way too young to be reading Richard Wright Black Boy.
Oh, wow. Oh,
but we're going to let you read this, and then we're going to take you to a civil rights museum, and you're going to see all of this, and then we're going to roll in the TV on that big-ass TV tray.
Yeah.
And we're going to watch a couple of slavery documentaries. But it was all very heavy-handed, and it was all grown-up-ass mm-hmm. curriculum. So I know that definitely. I don't want to be that dad where my kid gets older and has to fill in the blanks. My father was a big time activist in the civil rights movement. He was a black journalist. And so he covered pretty much any march you can show me a picture of. My dad is probably three rows back from the front covering it. So he didn't water down racism to me. It was, I used to go to his speaking engagements and these white folks coming to get us and you got to get ready. Yep. Like, it was very poignant at the time.
Yeah.
But I know I couldn't talk like that to my son because he would immediately just go to an Army-Navy store and get, like, a couple of small blades. And I go, listen, I didn't say get ready for a race war. I just said be ready if someone calls you the N-word. You got to know how to handle yourself.
Yeah. So, wait, so your dad was a journalist. And now you're a fake journalist on The Daily Show.
But you were a real journalist at one point, or you were
on
the radio.
Yeah, I did radio. I mean, it's as much as journalistic as you expect hip-hop morning radio to be. I mean, it's technically by occupation journalism, but man, can you believe that DMX and Dragon got beef at the Rough Riders?
We have journalist Roy Wood Jr. here to tell us about what happened.
Yeah, like, it's funny because my dad was never really... I'm turning into my father stylistically. But when I first started, Stuart Scott is why I wanted to do journalism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Hurry.
Yeah, come on.
Can we just take a moment and reflect on the awesomeness that is Stuart Scott?
Yes, we can. We should.
But Stuart Scott was a longtime sportscaster and anchor on ESPN, but that doesn't say enough. How would you describe Stuart Scott?
He brought himself to his job. Like, he wasn't willing to become an archetype of a sportscaster, and this happened today, and this in a home run. And then, you know, it was he brought his own flair to it. He brought funny expressions. He was, you know, he was himself. Yeah. And also as one of the few black anchors on SportsCenter, it was a very important job. And also he didn't shy away. I think it was easy, especially when you're forced to conform and you're one of the few black anchors, to just be any anchor. But he was like, no, I'm going to be me. Mm-hmm. And he brought all these wonderful phrases that people still use. And I think he opened up sports casting to be a form of entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. And he's also often imitated
yes.
by lesser individuals. But here, just sit back and listen to Stuart Scott.
Third inning, Derek Jeter in first. Booyah! Alex Rodriguez, second homer in two nights.
Who's got the best left hook, right cross in sports?
Sure.
Top five, booyah! Royce Clayton takes Juan Guzman out. Royce, slow your roll, kid. It's only his fifth homer of the year, but he rushed it and crushed it 423 feet.
You have to actually try and be that bad. That's horrid. Again, though, not as bad as Carl Lewis. At least Finney can sing. Finney's a rap mogul. Finney can rap. Carl Lewis threw that thing down,
where's
and he
street
butchered
cred now after that? Is that street cred or not?
Well, you know, the brothers ain't playing baseball in the street, so he still got street cred. He just ain't got no baseball cred.
Because he taught black and cracked jokes about yep. sports.
Yeah, yeah.
Shit, we did that at the lunch table.
Yeah.
Every day. So when Stuart Scott's rise to prominence came, like, because real talk, I was just going to be a firefighter. I was like, all right, high school is cool.
Yeah.
If I don't get drafted by the Cubs, firefighter.
Now, did you think you might get drafted by the Cubs, or was that just like...
Nah, okay. Was just wishful
okay, I didn't know if you were like, I was actually a prospect.
He just threw out the Cubs' first pitch recently.
Yeah, that is the closest I will ever get to playing for the Cubs.
While wearing a Chicago Cubs bathrobe.
That's right, man.
Wow.
Pimping. I had clothes on under it, though. Like, so for me, when Stuart Scott came into prominence, that's when I kind of pivoted to journalism. So I go to Florida A&M. I start doing comedy while I'm there. And then when I graduated, at the time, like, this is 01. So the only way to, like, really, I thought, as a comedian, grow is to get on the radio. You got to get on the radio. And then you be funny on the radio.
Yeah.
Then they book you for all the shows.
Yeah.
So the only way to get on the radio was to do prank phone calls. And at the time, Ricky Smiley had just left. So I was able to come in and replace Ricky. And I basically went to the station and was just like, look, I have a degree in this. And I also tell jokes. Maybe I could do both of these in this building. And they were cool with it. And so I look back on it now, and that definitely was the beginnings of that transition into, like, that comedic journalistic satire type stuff. Because it's find the headline, then have an opinion about the headline. And it doesn't matter if it's politics or if it's black pop culture, who fought who, what rapper got beef with what rapper. It's really no different than, I mean, if Trump's administration just treat him like a rap label.
Right.
Trump is Shook.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yep. Bannon is Dre.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So it's like you treat it in that same style.
Yeah.
So approaching the stories were very easy. And so, yeah, now I guess technically I am a journalist of sorts.
Did you start doing stand-up when you were in college, or was it after?
No, in college. I started my junior year, and that was probably the smartest thing I could have done. It kept me out of mischief.
Roy, the special is really good. Father Figure is really good.
I appreciate it.
It made me really angry. It was so good. I was watching it, and I was like, this is not fair. This is too good. Because there's only a handful of comedians I watch, and I'm like, I laugh. Because mostly it's like, all right, this is good. All right, it's good. It was funny, Roy. It was funny.
I appreciate it, man.
I laugh. You, Hannibal, and Kamau when he's present in the room. and that's about it. And I was just, it was so, that bit, I was just rehearing it before the interview, just the bit about blues.
Oh, yeah, black people in the blues.
Black folks been trying to tell y'all forever that they've had some issues, and we invented the blues. What more of a sign that you need? We literally invented an entire genre of music based on sadness. That's how sad we the blues was created here. That is an American art form. That is not native African. You go listen to old African music. The shit is happy because we was free. Come on. Every old African song, we're the freedom in Africa. Freedom, Africa, freedom, Africa. Soon as we got off the slave ship.
You guys could probably speak to this some. Like, with Dick Gregory dying.
Yes.
And so I was kind of reflecting on that. So I don't want to say I opened for Dick Gregory. I emceed a banquet he was speaking at.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that counts as opening.
At this point, yes.
You know what? No, because some motherfuckers are like if Seinfeld did a drop-in set on your open mic night,
yeah,
then you'll say, oh, I performed with Seinfeld. Shut the fuck up.
I was talking about that's the sign of a comedian that doesn't have real credits yet, and I've been there where they're just like all the people you've been on the stage the same time. Or sometimes I've seen performed at this venue where this person has performed.
Dude, I used to lie my ass off.
So you opened for Dick Gregory.
So I opened for Dick Gregory, and this is 2011, and I feel like, you know, you feel like you got jokes.
Yeah.
You feel like you're doing this. I'm like, all right, I've been doing this about 13, 14 years. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And Dick Gregory is up there with a podium. Yeah. And to me, a podium is like a laugh blocker.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, jokes cannot get over a podium. Dick Gregory's killing.
Yeah.
He's killing at a fucking banquet where nobody's eating anymore. And the pauses that he's taking, you think it's just like an old dude remembering where he was, but it was deliberate. It was crafted. Yeah. And it was so much truth packed into what he was talking about that it kind of changed me creatively in a way where I'm like, all right, well, I can try and talk about some stuff. I'm no Dick Gregory. I haven't lived his life, so I can never speak from that level of with that amount of gravity that he has. But I can, instead of doing a joke about something lighthearted, I can at least go, all right, look, let's talk about the Confederate flag and some of its upsides. You know, and try to talk about how, you know, if we get rid of the Confederate flag, you know, how will we know who the racist white people are? And like, and that's a legitimate question and just exploration. And just so my goal has been since that time to, at the minimum, just try and figure out the angle nobody else took on the edgy thing or taking the edgy thing head on. What I'm trying my best not to become, and I feel like there's, I'm not going to say there's a lot of this in comedy, but I see more often in comedy, as they call it, clapter.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's applause in the place of a punchline. That's just a really dope speech you gave, bro.
Yeah.
And it was good. But there was no joke. It's and did they do that? And screw them, neck roll. And and it gets an applause break. And to me, that's not a joke. It's a great point.
Yeah.
But there has to be something between that. And
I'm okay with clapter.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you work at the Daily Show, which is a place where the audience they kind of show up to do clapter. So you know what I mean? Like they I'm not saying that they don't want the jokes, but they certainly will appreciate, like, a well-made point. You know what I mean?
But they'll write that out of the script.
Oh, really?
Oh, they'll write it out of the script. They'll look at something on the first pass. Like, we'll go through and write a first pass of the show, and then at 1 o'clock we do rewrite. And Trevor and the EPs, you'll be sitting there with them sometimes if you're on the show, and they'll go, yeah, that's just a good point. That's not funny. There's a better way to make that point.
Yeah.
Or you flip that point into an analogy, or you—
yeah.
There's a better way to say what you just said than just hitting the nail right on the head.
Yeah.
Then they'll go for that.
Sure, but I think there's a difference between clapping and clapter. Like, clapping is clapping. I think a clapter to me is like they're clapping, but they're still laughing. That means that they find it funny and they think it's righteous.
Okay, well, then that's different. Then we're talking about two different things. I'm just talking about when somebody just goes, yeah, yeah.
Where there's no laughter.
Oh, that's clapping.
Yeah.
Trump's a dick and we got to get him out of there.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Where was the joke in that? You just said Trump's a dick. Yes, we agree. And we clap because it's a greether.
Yeah. Right. Well, I remember because Chris talked about this with Tully Bias.
Oh, yeah.
Chris, you know, Chris Rock.
Yeah.
He talked about the idea of the clapter too. And I always felt like, at the very least, when everybody claps, the thing that I feel like is like, okay, now we're on the same page. Now there should be a joke that follows this.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, if you're all going to clap, yay, okay, that means we're all on the same place. Now it's my job to figure out what the joke is on the other side.
The clapping becomes part of the setup.
Yeah, the clapping has to be part of the setup. It can't be just the, like, we all agree. For my next joke, that's not the end of the. Yeah. That's just the idea of, like, it's, if you're a magician, that's just saying we know what the trick's going to be. Now do the thing that we can't do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was seeing Dick Gregory it changed that. But then what I think about, and this is what I want to ask you guys to bring back to the original question.
Oh, now that we're on your show.
But it's something I cope with, though. Do you think politically edgy humor, how does it grow? Where does it grow now? Because you sneak one cell phone into a show and you upload that video and that audio or that joke without any sense of context. Mm-hmm. And as a comic, you're fucked, or at the minimum, you're backpedaling and trying to figure out how to save face because a bunch of people want you to apologize for something. I'm not saying there aren't jokes out there that are out of line, but I'm saying that when you're trying to push the edge, as a comic is supposed to do, every now and then you're going to go too far. And the margin for error is so narrow now, way more narrow than Carlin or Bruce or Gregory or Mooney or any of those guys ever had to deal with. So.
Although a lot of those guys were arrested occasionally for just shocking. Yeah.
Like, so, just throwing it in their mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Just like, you know, I always think it's funny. Lenny Bruce was arrested for obscenity in San Francisco. You know, which to me is like, aren't we about up? Didn't we invent a lot of the obscene things out here? But I hear what you're saying. I mean, it's funny. I just went on I went and saw Chris on tour, and Chappelle does this too, where they make everybody in the audience like lock their phone up in a little case.
It's been the most peaceful past year because you don't hear anything about anything.
You don't hear
the show.
Nobody's material. No grainy cell phone video of a weird moment in the show where look at Dave Chappelle not be able to bump up, you know.
They do that at the Comedy Works at Denver because Dave was there and he got them all, you know.
He bought them the system.
I think he either bought it for his shows there and left it or he asked for it.
Yeah.
And in order to get him, they bought it. And they're like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Because like there's no stress anymore because it feels like, you know, there's certain times, like, you know your jokes, but there's times where, like, I want to go in this direction just to see where it goes.
Yeah.
And sometimes you see where it goes, and you're like, I'm never going there again. Yeah. So how else was I supposed to know?
Yeah.
You know, and you can do so much work as a human to, like, make yourself as righteous as possible and learn things, but you're still going to fuck up.
Well, yeah, especially like you're saying, I think the thing I feel like is that we are in a little bit of a missing link part of the stand-up comedy. Like, there's going to be something that happens after this that's going to be like, oh, that was weird. We were in that point of like, but I feel like right now we are at a point where everybody is so, and I don't say this in the way that it's that some in a negative way, everybody sort of also is sensitive, super sensitive right now, and not in a way that's like, you're being too sensitive, but we're all a little raw.
Well,
you know?
It's also, I don't think people understand stand-up and they hold it to a particular standard because it's accessible. When something happens in a movie, more people are going to see it. It's usually more fucked up, more graphic, more visual. Yet, who are you blaming? Mm-hmm. There's too many people involved. There's directors, there's actors, there's writers. There's a studio. When an individual says some stupid shit, even if only 30 people hear it, that person's a monster.
You.
And that's it. There's no, there must have been a reason. There was a mistake. The fact we do our first draft as the presentation.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a raw and honest art form that, like, it's easy to immediately pin the comic. And that's not to take the accountability away from the performer. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but this is one thing we did once in this one setting, and hopefully we learned from it or we figured out. It's different than, like, it's a TV special. I'm marking this down. This is my statement until I record something else that maybe questions what I said. But at least for now, this is what I'm saying. It's different than 30 people. There's no.
It's different. Well, let's be clear. It's different than Hannibal in Philly,
right?
Making a Bill Cosby joke because he's like, "I'm in Philly. This is what comics are supposed to do."
And no one's supposed to be filming this.
Yeah. I wasn't getting this ready. It may have never ended up on a special, but I hear what you're saying. I think the problem is also too is that even once it gets to your special, people are watching comedy on TV. Let's, for example, say like SNL, with their computers open on Twitter. So they're not even focused 100% on the thing. They're kind of grading it. I'm sure it happened on The Daily Show, too.
Oh, yeah.
They're sort of grading it as they're watching it.
With no reflection.
Yeah. There's not a sense that you're not taking in the thing as a whole and then reflecting on it. You're actually everybody's being like color commentary in sports. So like nobody's actually even focusing on the comedy as its own thing.
Yeah. I was reading the transcript, responding.
Or somebody's just piggybacking off of what everybody else is already saying.
Yeah.
So it's that pivot where you don't even live in your own opinion long enough for fear of being on the outside of something.
Yeah.
People are so raw that they don't even want to joke about not going. I did a piece last night about the fucking white supremacists and giving them advice. The whole premise of the piece is Trump is already pushing your agenda. Lay low and stop having rallies. Mm-hmm. And let this dude, he's giving you a hookup.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up and enjoy your hookup.
Yeah.
Somebody tweeted me last night, don't give them any advice. How could you give them advice? We need to resist. Motherfucker. Do you not understand the context of this?
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, it's also like one person. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the one, like, sometimes I'll get.
No, but you know how that is.
It's how it starts with one, right?
Yeah, but then that comes to, 14, 50? It becomes an issue once it becomes written about and it turns into a bunch of articles. And it's like, shit.
But I feel like that, but I hear, the thing is that with comedy, the idea of, like, the context is being often taken away.
Right.
He's on a thing called The Daily Show.
Yeah.
It's very famously a parody of the news. Like, it's very famously. A lot of times, certainly through the history of The Daily Show, the correspondents take unpopular. The whole idea is trying to take a weird take on an issue.
Right. Yeah.
And you're not, the correspondents on The Daily Shows are not supposed to be heroes. You know what I mean? They're not, like, Jon Stewart was kind of, Trevor's the hero. But the correspondents are sort of the foils for stuff. And so for me, it's like you're actually not letting them. We know this.
Well, then it probably speaks more to when people say, like, I get all my news from The Daily Show. It's like, well, that's why you're so fucking pissed off, because you're not seeing, you don't realize this is comedy because you're not seeing anything else. But that's on you.
And that's the problem, is that now jokes are being taken as marching orders. Yeah. I want to laugh while you tell me for real what to do. Take your ass to a speech. This is a comedy club.
Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a whole book for you.
I had a joke about the Confederate flag from my special that over the weekend, after things died down in Charlottesville, I went back and forth with myself about this would be the perfect time to post it, post a little 2-minute snippet, re-promote the special, it's topical, and the joke. But the joke now, in February, fine joke.
Yeah.
But the joke now, somebody, if they really wanted to, could construe it as me defending the Confederate flag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even though I'm in a room with a microphone and 800 people, you'll still think it is a real speech.
Yeah.
So I can't repost it.
Yeah. I remember having watched The Daily Show for years. The Daily Show starts out, Jon Stewart starts out with Craig Kilborn, and then Jon Stewart takes it over. Mm-hmm. It becomes a parody of the news. I remember for years watching The Daily Show being like, it's weird this is a parody of the news. The news has more people of color than this show does. Mm. Then at some point, John brings in Larry Wilmore, brings in Wyatt.
Trayvon Free.
Yeah.
As a writer.
Yeah, Che for a week and a half.
Yeah, Michael Che.
Yeah, Michael Che. And and brings in
Madrigal.
And, and it's like, okay, good. This now feels Jessica Williams. Yeah, it feels like, okay, there's more. Good job, everybody. And then the first night that Trevor comes on, he's on, black man, you're on, black man, Kevin Hart is the guest. Yes. And I was like, this has got to be the most black people ever on one episode of The Daily Show in the history of The Daily Show.
To be.
Yeah, it was like, I'm not going to Google it. I'm not going to do any research. I'm just going to confidently say this is the most black people, certainly the most black men ever in the history of The Daily Show. And it felt like a sea change has happened. Like, before, the diversity was this thing that was brought into it. And now Trevor's sitting at the desk, and he's not doing the thing where it's like, well, I'm black. There can't be more black people on this thing. You know, he's kicked the door open, inviting everybody through. And also creates a very big thing where it's like, there's different types of black.
Yes.
There's Trevor, who's this black dude from South Africa, and there's you.
I'm regular black. <You're> regular. That's what we always joke about in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, Trevor's not having to hold the weight of regular black. He's not having to talk as if he is regular black because he's fancy black.
I think the convenience of it is because Trevor came up in a system that was very parallel to segregation, and I would argue worse in a lot of degrees. I mean, I'm not here to rank racist subjugation, but Trevor's perspective is so worldly, and I think the biggest difference between Trevor and I in terms of blackness is temperament. And as a host, he has this uncanny ability to be even keeled, and no matter how serious or horrid the issue is, to be the rock, to be that North Star of this is the issue, this is why this sucks, this is, and like a perfect example would be, if I can pick a cop shooting.
Yeah.
And Trevor will handle it with levity and gravity. And depending on the incident, there may be a joke. Sometimes there isn't. There's Trevor's done 7-minute opening monologues without a single joke about cop killings. If I'm the host of The Daily Show and I'm asked to do the same thing, I don't know if I can do it without or just a little anger.
It's a different show.
Yeah, it's just a different feel. Yeah. And so there are different types of blackness. And, you know, we had Jessica Williams for the time that we were blessed to have her. And her perspective was very much different from ours. And that's why I'm so excited. I can't even say who, but, like, I'm so excited for who we're bringing in now because it's going to be some more dope shit happening on
the
show.
Because you also, Gina Yashere is on it.
Yeah, Gina Yashere, who is, and this is by her own admission, she says she checks all the boxes. She's black, she's foreign, she's a lesbian, and she's a woman. So it doesn't get more exquisite than that when you talk about...
Could she convert to Islam? Is that a thing she could do?
Yeah, I think Trevor, by intent, has definitely tried to make the show more culturally diverse, but also more globally diverse. Because you also... You have Ronnie Chang, and it's like, all right, it's one thing to just go, all right, let's get an Asian. Never been an Asian. Let's get an Asian correspondent. Well, let's get one from Singapore. He's pretty funny. Singapore, he's from Malaysia. He knows a lot of different stuff. He's got some perspective. And Ronnie,
didn't he live in Australia, too?
Yeah.
So it's a whole,
So it's like this dude has this global perspective that also can be applied to domestic politics. And we live in a world that's far smaller than we'd like to think. And I think Trevor, in doing that, has opened the show up globally, beyond America, in my opinion.
How diverse is the writing and production staff now?
Oh, it's very.
Yeah?
It's very. Like, it's to the point now, and I know this is probably racist of me to think, but anytime I see a new black person walking around, I'd be like, who the fuck is this? Who let you in? How you getting here? And then I see the name badge. I'm like, oh, hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
Oh,
you're an editor? Yeah. That's dope. We need black editors. Edit them black jokes, man.
He's like, I'm also doing some open mics. No, man. Focus on your editing. That's where we need you.
But as far as people of color and women in the writer's room, Trevor is very cognizant of that and very cognizant of, you know, making sure that a lot of different voices are, you know, spoken to, because I feel like you can't write from that perspective. And that's why the pushback in the writer's meetings is so important, because you may have a joke that you think should go one way and someone will go, actually that might, you shouldn't do that, because then there's people who think this. And I think that type of diversity is very important. It's like, I can look at The Daily Show now and can completely see how a show that's just staffed by white men could just put their fucking foot in their mouth every now and then with something in their script or something in the plot of a show. It's just, you're just literally out of touch. There was no one in the room to tell you, hey, maybe that black person shouldn't do that in this scene.
Yeah.
And so that balance is very important. And I think that's something that Trevor, you know, works at probably a lot more than he gets credit for. You know, I know you're not supposed to get crazy. You're supposed to take care of your kids. Yeah. But I think you have to have, in this day and age, I don't want to say a responsibility, but it's very cool if you are a black person in power or you have an opportunity to empower other people, that you do it and you help other minorities. And then Trevor Noah does that. And in that regard, that's what I mean, where, like, it's like you could say he's African, but that's also something that's very American in terms of reaching down and helping the next person up. And it's something that I'm very cognizant of, because if ever I'm in the opportunity or if ever I'm in a position to do the same, I know I got to do that.
Yeah.
Because that's how you help people going forward. Now, you know, I'm not going to just come in and fire all the white people. But if one of them left, I'd be like, hey.
This is an opportunity.
Hey, nigga, what you doing?
I'd fire all the white people.
First day.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Well, thanks for coming by today, Roy.
Yeah,
appreciate
Roy.
I appreciate you.
Yeah. We appreciate you. Thanks for doing the big work, man.
The special's good, Roy. It's really good.
I'm going to post that Confederate clip. Fuck it. See what happens.
I'm glad this is a whole intervention to get you to post
show
that clip.
Correspondent Roy Wood Jr. and disrespecting March.
Hey, come out. Did you learn something today?
I learned that Roy's dad was a journalist who covered major civil rights events, so it makes sense that Roy would end up on The Daily Show covering current major civil rights events. Hey, what'd you learn?
I learned that we all together defined clapter. It's not just clapping and laughing, it's really just applauding. So clapter is a nonsense word. What we meant was applause.
I feel like you're going to get a text from Chris Rock.
Just don't think clapter is a problem. I think clapping is a different issue than clapter. As long as they're laughing, says man defending himself.
Yes. I learned that Francesca Ramsey went to internet camp when she was a kid, which makes me feel old because there was no such thing as internet camp when I was a kid. Not even anything, nothing, no.
I learned that being on the internet for more than 10 years has made Francesca accessible to people. That also means she's particularly accessible to harassment. So there's a win-lose there. Like, oh, I can reach you, I can be funny, you can understand things, but also you will treat me like shit on the internet.
Yeah, I can threaten you more effectively because I know everything about you. I learned that Roy's been a dad for 16 months, and it already feels like a long time. Hurry, I guess it's like if you go to the same coffee shop for like a year and a half or so, it's like you feel like you have a long relationship with that coffee shop. Is that how you look at it?
Yeah, except it would be the coffee shop forcing me to do things because I love the coffee shop so much that I had to do things for the coffee shop constantly.
Well, it's like how they force you to order a particular way.
Right.
It's basically like being a parent.
Yeah, but then I have to pay for it versus... I guess that parallel...
Yeah, it's totally like...
It's exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for our show. Thanks again to Roy Wood Jr. and Francesca Ramsey. Follow Roy on Twitter at Roy Wood Jr. That's R-O-Y-W-O-O-D-J-R. Follow Francesca at Cheska Leigh. That's C-H-E-S-C-A-L-E-I-G-H. Keep sending us Twitter and Facebook messages. We absolutely love them. So keep those comments and questions coming using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. And also, go rate us on iTunes, like a 5-star with a glowing review. Do something good with your day. And we still have a limited supply of new t-shirts, so don't miss out. Visit podswag.com/PR or podswag.com/politicallyreactive. Both work. And also, we hear you. We are pushing for t-shirts in different cuts, bigger sizes, and baby sizes. We're working on getting some more. Keep the heat on them. And also, pick up a copy of my new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. You can get it at your local bookstore or at wkamaubell.com. Also, pick up a copy of Hari's album, Hari Kondabolu's New Material Night, Volume 1. You can find it at harikondabolu.com.
Hold up, wait a minute. I gotta talk about my dates, Kamau. Today, I'm in Burlington, Vermont at Vermont Comedy Club through September 2nd. I need you there, Burlington. It's Labor Day weekend. I need you there. Come on. Then on September 15th, I will be at the Underground Collaborative in Milwaukee doing 2 shows. I want you to go to one or both of them. Actually, just go to one of them. 2 is a lot. Then on September 17th, I will be in Cleveland at Hilarities. Then you have Boston at the Wilbur on November 3rd, Eugene, Oregon, Tacoma, Washington, Santa Cruz, Oakland, Portland, and the hits keep coming, and also New Orleans. All on my website, harikondabolu.com.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic and distributed by Earwolf. Our executive producers are Lisa Leingang and Lee Tomalad. The show is produced by Tim Barnes and Laura Flynn. The show is engineered by Dan Gallucci. Thanks to Jared O'Connell at Earwood Studios in New York for recording help this week. And thanks as always to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.